Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. How much is too much?
It's everyone's prerogative to spend what they want, but think about how much money that is.
That's Tiffany Leungren with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. She's in a financial predicament.
It's everyone's prerogative to spend what they want, but think about how much money that is.
What's got Tiffany thinking about spending limits? Is it A, a hybrid car? They're better on gas mileage, but can cost thousands more than regular autos. Or could it be B, her wedding? Experts say the average nuptials cost more than $28,000. Or is it C, fancy denim? Tiffany's trying to stick to a budget, but those true religion jeans are calling her name. Can't come up with the right fit? Stick around. The answer's on this week's Marketplace Money, next from American Public Media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money.
You could exchange the SUV for a Prius. You could put solar panels on your roof. How about something that won't set your wallet on fire? We'll take the temperature. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
So, what are you doing to help the environment these days? In our household, we've changed several incandescent bulbs to compact fluorescent. What we keep forgetting to do is unplug all of our electronic stuff when we're not using it. Our bad. Well, this week, both the House and Senate considered bills to force all of us to save more energy, and not just with our cars. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports it may not be long before the government's reach extends to your kitchen.
To find out about the promise of home energy efficiency, I invited the president of the Alliance to Save Energy, Kateri Callahan, over to grade my appliances.
Oh, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Are you John?
I am.
Kateri Callahan.
Nice to meet you.
Ms. Callahan told me houses are big culprits when it comes to greenhouse gas pollution.
The average home emits more CO2 than the car in the driveway.
Half of a home's energy use is for heating and cooling. Adding insulation and sealing up cracks can save 20% on those bills. My furnace and air conditioner are both relatively new, but in the kitchen it was a mess.
I have obviously an old refrigerator. Is there something I can do to keep it more efficient longer?
I'd say replace it. honestly, I think that's best. One of the problems.
Not to mention my aging dishwasher.
If you were to replace this and put in an energy efficient and a water efficient dishwasher, you might be able to save about $120 a year.
And I've got machines that are slowly sucking electricity all the time.
We call it vampire power or parasitic power. And often you have equipment, DVDs, TVs, VCRs, that actually, over the course of a year, use more energy in the off mode than they do in the on mode.
Callahan's organization is working with the government to make appliances more energy efficient. But Ben Lieberman at the Heritage Foundation says mandates can hurt the little guy.
They benefit consumers only if the energy savings outweighs the costs, and the cost can take the form of the higher purchase price, also reduce product performance, features, reliability, longevity. In other words, the ultra-efficient, federally mandated appliance may save you on energy, but it doesn't work as well or last as long.
Better to let free market supply and demand forces drive manufacturers to build better appliances, he says. And Consumer Reports' latest tests of new clothes washers finds the most efficient models aren't necessarily the best at cleaning clothes. Celia Cooper-Smid-Lehrman is the deputy home editor of Consumer Reports.
One of the technologies, your sort of standard washing machine that opens on the top and has a post in the middle, those are center post agitators, having the most trouble using less water and getting clothes clean.
She recommends looking for a front-loading washing machine, but warns the good ones can cost $1,000. Energy efficiency advocates like Lowell Unger at the Alliance to Save Energy are happy about all the attention their issue is getting.
I think there's really a perfect storm on energy issues right now. People are looking to solutions to our energy problems, and more people are recognizing that energy efficiency is the quickest, cheapest, and cleanest way of addressing all of these issues.
In Congress, the House is close to approving a spending bill that would more than double the funding for setting and enforcing home appliance standards next year. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
Today we turn the page for Chapter 3 of our financial fairy tale. Our hero and heroine, Michael Fox and Tiffany Leungren, will tie the knot on September 1st. We're following them as they walk toward the aisle to have and to hold through sickness, health, and revolving credit card debt. We're back in the kingdom of Encinitas, California, where these are the days of wine and roses for Tiffany and Mike, or today at least, a day of wine. They're at Carlsbad Wine Merchants with sommelier Deborah DeFarcy, deciding which wines to serve at the wedding.
Is it an afternoon or an evening wedding?
Afternoon, evening.
Okay, so this would be something you could start off with. Also, we did.
DeFarcy recommends they count on 4 to 5 pours per bottle. But some wedding guests may cork the wine in favor of the margarita fountain that will accompany the couple's favorite local cuisine.
We grew up eating authentic San Diego Mexican food. And when we think, like, what if you could have the best meal, what would it be? And to me, it's a little spicy cilantro, salsa.
Bean cheese burrito, double wrap with sour cream.
Maybe not at the wedding.
Yeah.
A fairly challenging food selection to pair with wine, but DeFarcy, the sommelier, was up to the task.
You know, generally what I recommend in a party type setting like that is just something that's fairly easy drinking, that whether it's the ideal beverage pairing for your menu or not, you know, at least it's something people are going to enjoy. Let's pick a few things that we can try and that, you know, isn't going to cost you a lot and you can do a decent amount of.
At about $10 a bottle, Tiffany and Mike want to keep costs down, even though they're lucky enough to have someone else picking up big chunks of the tab.
My parents are paying for the majority of the wedding. Mike's parents are paying for the rehearsal dinner and a lot of the alcohol. I don't know what the budget is because my parents have kind of taken the ball and run with it. They booked the band already. The venue is my grandparents' house, so there's no cost associated with that, obviously. I've just been pitching ideas to my parents, and if they say no, it's too expensive, then I come up with another plan.
Apparently, the average American wedding costs $28,000. Where do you think you might fall on the scale?
I really think that we're probably, like, more on the lower end. I would think around, like, $10,000, somewhere around there.
Is that something that came out of a decision you made, that you didn't want to spend a lot of money?
I think a lot of this stems from my proclivity, even since I was a child, to not want to be a burden on my parents and not want to make them spend a lot of money on me, even though this is my wedding. And I think it's absolutely ridiculous to spend $28,000 on a wedding. It's everyone's prerogative to spend what they want, but think about how much money that is.
I totally agree.
There is a little bit of push and pull when it comes to deciding things about the wedding, though, because my parents are paying for it. And then it's kind of like, well, do I sound like a bridezilla when I say, it's our wedding, it's not yours, when it's really a family affair?
This is the Puerto Viejo Carmenere. So this is Chilean.
This would go really well with the carne asada.
Yeah, it's got nice fruit. It's got a lot of spice, too, so it will be able to stand up to something a little spicier.
Well, let me ask you guys, as you're continuing to sip, we've talked a lot the last couple of visits about merging your financial lives. Has anything come up that you've needed to sit down and talk about or that has surprised you?
This cat, she decided she wanted. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. We decided we wanted. The cat today had an accident in our closet. The expense of cleaning up after a cat is ridiculous.
The cat is really cute.
That's all I have to say. But in terms of day-to-day living, we're doing really well. We don't argue about money at all, really. We just trust each other, and he knows I'm responsible enough to not go out and buy a $1,000 pair of shoes when we don't have the money. And we've both lived on our own for so long.
He's got this look in his eyes like, well, you may not buy a pair of $1,000 shoes, but you went and got a cat.
It was a stray cat. No, it needed a home.
I do have something I've been saving up, though. The other day she said, what did you have for lunch? And I said, I had a sandwich. And she goes, well, did you have it at home? I said, no. She goes, you know, you need to start making sandwiches at home. You know, we need to save money. I'm trying to save money. I make my lunch, da-da-da-da. And so when I was dropping her off, I see her get out with her little coffee thing and go straight to the coffee cart. Well, why didn't she make coffee at home?
I normally do.
Uh-huh.
I was running late.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Welcome to Almost Marriage. And with that, we close chapter 3 of our financial fairy tale. You can find photos of Mike and Tiffany on our website. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, they seem a little bland, but bonds have been getting investors excited recently. Higher yields prompted buyers to get back into treasuries. Of course, that's not good news for folks hoping to get a mortgage. But one problem with bonds has been that it's nearly impossible to figure out what they really cost you. So in response to a lot of cajoling from regulators, many brokers are revamping their fees. And this week, Charles Schwab joined the list. Marketplace's Janet Babin is here to explain. Hey, Janet, what's going to happen now if you talk to Chuck?
Well, they're going to change the fee structure for bonds in a way that will make it easier for people to know what exactly they're buying. Most of the time before, when customers would buy a bond, they wouldn't really have a price breakout, so you weren't quite sure how much you were exactly paying for the bond. And another thing the company did, Schwab, is going to lower the prices for most people. Some investors will end up paying more, but on average, you'll pay about $1 per bond trade online.
So it sounds like this is very similar to the controversies that we've had over fees for stock trading, that they were very opaque, that you couldn't understand where the fees were. And it sounds like that's kind of being translated into bond trading now.
That's right. It was all about the commission, or they call them the markups, you know, the actual price to trade. And I think a few years ago, there was some research done and people figured out that bond trades were actually costing people a lot more than stock trades, but nobody really knew it. So now there's more transparency in buying a bond for an individual investor.
So transparency is obviously one benefit. How else are investors benefiting from some of these changes in bond buying?
I think the changes are helping to demystify this process of buying bonds, and individual investors are probably going to be adding them to their portfolios. I mean, if you think about the baby boomers, they really need bonds in that strategy because all investments are risky, but bonds can be less volatile than stocks, right? So they are something you do want in a long-term portfolio, but with all these barriers to figuring out how much a bond costs, it was impossible for people to know what they were buying. And you know, Tess, it's hard to believe, but just a few years ago, the prices bonds traded at were not available to the public.
Wow. So you would do a market report and you wouldn't have the bond prices.
Exactly. You can imagine how hard it would be for people who didn't buy bonds every day if you weren't a trader and you didn't know what the spread was for a bond, the bidding price or the asking price or whatever. But now there's been some regulatory changes. And so all those prices do have to be listed. And it's easy now for people to go to various websites and figure out how much the bonds are trading for.
All right. Marketplace's own bond queen, Janet Babin, thanks so much for helping us out.
Thank you, Tess.
Can your savings cost you money for grad school? Chris tutors us in the mailbag. And a job that hits all the right notes.
I have children who can sing to me what they can't say.
A day in the work life of a music therapist. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Feeling a little stressed? Try a visit to the Spanish hotel chain NH Hoteles. It's running an unusual competition for overworked executives. Along with a team of psychologists, the chain will pick 30 people, arm them with hammers and hard hats, and let them have at one of the hotel interiors. maybe they'd be better off with this next way of working out personal issues. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we meet a music therapist.
Hello, little angelies.
Hello, Miss Holly.
My name is Holly Miller. I'm 38 years old, and I'm a psychotherapist practicing music therapy. Music therapy makes a lot of sense to use with young children because they really don't have the ability to have insight about their lives. I mean, I can't really say, hey, let's go back and talk about your childhood or what kind of patterns brought you to this sort of behavior. I have children who can sing to me what they can't say. A lot of children I work with have autism, and a common feature of autism is difficulty with language and communication. Language and singing occupy two different parts of the brain, although some of it overlaps, but it gives me a different inroad to help them learn language. And these kids really learn how to speak using music. Music can be used with adults as well. In fact, I've had some people who have had anxiety and panic attacks that were so bad they couldn't drive the freeways. So in sessions, we've done relaxation skills, and then we've eventually paired that with a piece of music. And they've been able to take that piece of music and put it in their car, which gives them a skill that they can use outside of the office so that we can take them from being really, really anxious on the freeways to being functional. I originally started teaching piano, flute, and voice. I also had a degree in psychology, just because I always thought it was fascinating, and there was a little piece of me that wanted to be a brain surgeon when I was growing up. I started attracting a lot of families with special needs children, and people started saying to me, you know, you get more out of my child in a half-hour music lesson than their therapist does in an hour. I really realized I was sort of in over my head at that point. I needed more training, so I went back to school, and I became a psychotherapist. As a therapist, you really have to engage in a great deal of self-care. I exercise, I eat right, I go to the spa, I spend time with my husband and my dog. I do lots and lots of things to take care of myself so that when I'm with a person who's in pain, I'm fully present. If you're a psychotherapist or a music therapist, you can make anywhere between $30,000 a year and $100,000 a year or more. I make around $85,000 a year, depending on how much I choose to work. I had a wonderful lady come in to see me one time in her 70s, and I had a moment of fear thinking, oh my gosh, I'm too young. You know, maybe she thinks I can't help her. So I just faced it straight on, and I asked her, are age difference a problem for you? And she said to me, my last therapist died. I want a therapist who can be there for me and go the distance.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Klaus Andresen.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by the NASD Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at nasdfoundation.org.
A juicy plan to rid the world of spam brings us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, Operation Bot Roast. Operation Bot Roast is a beefy new FBI initiative that aims to skewer computer vandals and their use of botnets. What's a botnet? It's a group of computers that sends out viruses and spam, usually without the owner's knowledge. This week, FBI officials announced Operation Bot Roast identified more than 1 million infected computers. So do you want a home-cooked way to prevent your computer from getting overheated? Use the latest antivirus software, don't open suspicious email, or become a vegetarian.
Got a box full of letters. Thinking my life.
I'm Tess Vigeland, and you know what happens when the weather gets warm. It means summer is almost officially here. Time of lazy days and not-so-lazy personal financial advice, at least from our own financial answer man, Chris Farrell. How you doing, Chris?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Good. Not feeling too lazy today, I hope.
Well, I have a question for you, though.
Okay.
Okay, when does summer start? Because as far as I'm concerned, the sun is out, school's almost out. It's summertime.
I will say it is summer. It is officially summer. But before we get to answering any questions, please do take down our website address. It's marketplace.org. Click on the contact button there. Or you can give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. All right, let's hit the phones. We've got William on the line from Winterville, Georgia. Hi, William.
Hi, Tess. How are you today?
Very well, thank you. We talked to someone a couple of weeks ago from Georgia who said it was hot and dry. Is that still the case there?
Yes, ma'am. We just got a little teeny bit of rain in our part of Georgia the last 2 days. Not enough to do us any good, though. We're in the middle of a drought. We're like 111 inches of rain behind.
All right. Well, I understand that you've been holding on to some Coca-Cola stock for a little while. Tell us what your question is for Chris this week.
Well, Chris, my question is this. I have stock in Coca-Cola Hellenic Bottling in Greece, and I can't sell it. My broker can't sell it. My financial advisor can't find a way to sell it, and I'm just stuck with it.
So is this bottling company, is it a former subsidiary of Coca-Cola?
Yeah, I bought Coca-Cola Amatil in Australia, and they owned Coca-Cola Hellenic in Greece. Amatil spun Hellenic Bottling off. Well, I did sell Amatil for a loss. I'm stuck with this Hellenic Bottling, and if I could sell that, I'd actually have a small profit or break even. But I can't sell it. The only thing they've been telling me is I have to get a certificate for the stock and go to Greece, and they can't even get me a certificate.
Chris, can you explain something for us, which is why, if he owns stock in a subsidiary of Coca-Cola, why he can't sell it?
Okay, here's my puzzlement. Coca-Cola Hellenic Bottling Company is the world's second largest Coke bottler outside the U.S. If you go to Business Week, their company section, or Hoover.com or Yahoo, you can look up Coca-Cola Hellenic Bottling Company. And so what I can't understand is why you can't sell it at all, because it's trading on the New York Stock Exchange. So it's highly liquid. It's followed by some major Wall Street analysts. Their research reports out on it. So you should be able to sell it.
Okay. Well, I'll inform my broker about that. He's been telling me all along I can't.
Now the other thing is whether in some of the mergers and acquisitions you have something that should have expired in one of these mergers and acquisitions, in which case what you would contact is the Coca-Cola Hellenic Bottling Company Investor Relations, because sometimes you might have owned a little piece of something that they acquired and then you would be bought out, which, by the way, they still have to pay you off.
Yeah. I know I'm supposed to get my money somehow. Now, like I say, this all happened a long time ago, and I've changed my investment strategy, and I use the Marlon Brando method now, and that works much better.
And what is that?
What is that?
Well, he made a movie in which he was a mafia kingpin, and he was speaking to his stockbroker, and he told him, I don't like it when stocks that you buy me go down, so only buy me stocks that go up.
We like that method.
I really appreciate your help with this one, because I've been stuck.
Terrific question. Let us know what you find out.
I will get back to you as soon as I've sold it and tell you what I had to go through to do it.
Fantastic. Thanks for the call.
Bye.
All right, let's check out the email bag. Liz wrote in from Westlake, Ohio, and for years, she and her husband have worked and saved and have a great nest egg for retirement. And apparently that savings gene was passed on to their daughter, who has now socked away $3,000 in savings and $15,000 in stocks. Now, the daughter is going to be starting Johns Hopkins School of Medicine this fall, and they were originally told by the financial aid office that a lot of students get a combination of grants and scholarships and loans. But here we go. When the financial aid department saw their financial status, they have this nest egg. Even though their daughter has supported herself for a year now, they only offered her government loans for only 2/3 of the amount. No grants, no scholarships. So what is the best way for dealing with what's going to be a very expensive medical education?
It is going to be expensive. And there is this twist to it, which is that as far as the medical school is concerned, financial aid department, you're considered financially dependent on your parents, even if they don't claim you.
But isn't this really just another example of whether you're going to college or a graduate school, medical school, law school, you are almost punished for having any form of savings, whether it's a savings account or stocks or a retirement account. They take all of that into account when they determine what they're going to give you for loans and grants and that sort of thing.
You are actually penalized by savings. The difference is, and I think there's a lot of evidence, is that your student and the parents, they have more financial freedom, and you don't really know what financial aid is going to be, how much financial aid you're going to get. So I really still encourage parents for undergraduates to continue to save for their child, even though there may be a financial aid penalty, because I think you're buying an option and you end up with a lot more choice. You're going to have to run the numbers and just see how you're going to make this work. There's no magic bullet here.
No magic bullet. So is there a best way to go about trying to figure out how to finance this?
Well, you know, she'll be able to do some of it through the savings. And then as far as what the parents are going to have to decide is how much do they want to contribute? Do they want their daughter to do some private sector borrowing? Do they want themselves to try and top off the money? Are there some work-study programs? So you're going to be looking at a lot of budgets, a lot of issues about indebtedness, loan payment requirements, and deciding, you know, how the family is going to treat this investment as a family.
Wow. Well, you know, you think you do everything right, you save for the future, but you still get hit with that proverbial financial sucker punch. We can help out. Click on the contact button on our website, marketplace.org, or call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. That's M-O-N-Y. Let's go to the phones again. Brian is on the line from Miami, Florida. Hi, Brian.
How are you?
Very well. And you?
Very well.
What's your question for Chris today?
Okay, so Chris, my mother and I were speaking a couple days ago, and I happened to find out that she has absolutely no retirement savings to speak of. She has no savings even, I understand, and I wanted to see if you might recommend something given her situation, which is that she's about 45 years old. She makes between $60,000 and $70,000 nowadays. She has the option to contribute to a 401k where she works, but she has not contributed anything at all.
What industry is she in, Brian?
She's an assistant principal, actually.
Oh, so she's in education.
That's right.
Wow, so that the 401k, is there also a pension by any chance?
I think there is. I know she knows that she'll be able to retire at 62 or something like that and get some kind of benefits. Okay. She doesn't know anything about that besides
all right,
that.
So she's probably counting, Chris, on the pension, but hasn't saved anything else outside of that.
Correct.
That's right. So, I mean, actually, your mom, in one sense, is in a decent situation because she does have a pension. That pension will provide her, as Tess said, an income during her retirement years. I would still recommend that she join the 401k. One nice thing about 401ks, you don't have to make that much of an adjustment. Mm-hmm. It just comes automatically out of your paycheck. And what most people do, and it sounds like maybe your mom did, you kind of spend what goes into the checking account. So if there's a little bit less going into the checking account because it's going into this tax-deferred savings, you hardly even feel it. And over, you know, 15 years, the money compounds. She'll have herself a nice little addition to her nest egg, to her savings. So I would strongly recommend that she participate to the full.
So, Brian, this is great that you've noticed this and called, you know, attention to your mother's situation. Are you saving for retirement?
I haven't. I actually
Brian.
Happen to. Oh no! I know. I happen to have heard recently that there is some kind of setup for which people that are independent contractors or self-employed, they have some kind of fantastic retirement option available to them. Is that the case for somebody like me who referees basketball games on the side?
Chris?
Oh, you're self-employed? Oh, yeah, absolutely. For the simplest one, for someone who has moonlighting, has an extra job on the side, is what we call a SEP IRA. A SEP IRA is a wonderful retirement savings plan for the self-employed. It requires basically no paperwork. I mean, you just have to pick your mutual fund company, financial institution you're going to work with. They send you a form. You sign it. You make your choices. Your money compounds, tax deferred. So it's really an ideal retirement savings vehicle for anybody who is self-employed.
And Chris, couldn't he also get started on a Roth IRA?
Oh, absolutely. I just love Roth IRAs. I think there's nothing not to love about a Roth IRA. Now, it's true, you're contributing to the Roth IRA with after-tax dollars, but your money compounds tax deferred, and then when you pull the earnings out in retirement, it's tax-free.
Great. And you'd recommend that for somebody like me who's about in their early 20s?
Especially if you're young.
Oh, absolutely. Especially because then, I mean, think about how long you have for this money to compound in your favor.
So get started. Get yourself started and then get your mother started as well.
Will do.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Thanks so much.
Well, even though retirement sometimes seems really far away, it's never too early or too late to start thinking about it. If you've got some questions, we've got the answers. Give us a call and we'll shed some light on it. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Or visit our website, marketplace.org, and click on the contact button. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, Todd wrote in from Rochester, Minnesota, and he has a 403B with his current employer, and I'll point out that that is the nonprofit equivalent of a 401K. He's also set up a Roth IRA on his own, but his 403B has no employer match, and as we know, the Roth grows tax-free. The 403B is tax-deferred. So he is wondering about moving the balance from his 403B to the Roth. So this is what we call a rollover. Can he roll over from the 403B even though he's still working for his employer? No.
He cannot. You need to have left your employer, and then you can do a rollover. The real story here is he has his 403B. He's with his employer. You continue to contribute. I applaud Todd for also having the Roth IRA, but he cannot roll over his 403B into a Roth until he's left his employer.
So the recommendation then is to just go ahead and keep contributing to the 403B and the Roth at the same time. If and when he leaves his employer, he can go ahead and look at a possible rollover.
That's right. And, you know, and just to throw in another thing, Tess, I mean, a lot of times we don't have that much choice. But, you know, when you are looking for a job and you're sort of trying to figure out, am I going to do this? Am I going to do that? You know, one of the things is look very closely at the retirement plan. That match is really an important benefit. Companies should be offering the match to encourage their employees to save for their retirement. So, you know, it's one thing when he's thinking about a job change sometime down the road, he may also want to throw into how you evaluate a company is, what is the retirement plan and is it a good one?
All right. Terrific. Well, Todd, we hope that helped you out. Thanks for the great question. Unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show. But please do leave your question for a future program on our voicemail. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. We spell that M-O-N-Y. Or visit our contact page on our website, marketplace.org. Chris, as always, thanks for the great advice.
It's been a lot of fun.
Our own Rico Galliano has been learning about buying a home. On the next Educating Rico, he gets a chance to show off.
Well, you know who I bet has an expert who could tell us a little bit about escrow?
Who?
Me, back in the studio.
Well, let's talk to you then.
All about escrow. And we've seen some odd investment schemes, but this one could save your life. Stem cell banks. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. The cracks are getting bigger in the foundation of the nation's housing market. Foreclosures and mortgage delinquencies spiked in the first quarter, and mortgage interest rates are at their highest level in almost a year. But folks are still buying homes. Our own Rico Galliano has been tagging along with a friend who's getting into the L.A. market. They've gone through everything from picking a real estate agent to finding the right mortgage. Today, Rico gets educated about a very important and mystifying word in the real estate business.
Hi, I'm Rico. Last time around, my pal Rick had found the loft of his dreams. Now he just has to survive a few more weeks of living with his current roommates.
We're out in the little garden section in front of where I live, and one of my roommates has left out here his plastic container is supposed to keep cereal fresh, and it is home to a colony of, it looks like, hundreds of moths have used his cereal as the basis for their civilization.
Is this perhaps one reason why you're looking for your own pad?
That's one of them, yeah.
The other reason he's getting his own pad is so he can spend tons and tons of money. That's what he's going to end up doing today. In his hands, he holds a cashier's check for $86,000.
And I'm waiting for the document lady from the escrow company to turn up so I can sign the escrow papers and give them the remainder of the down payment here.
Now, hear that word, escrow? It occurs to me I've heard it all my life and never really knew what it meant. It's a weird word, escrow. It stuck in my head even as a kid when I thought it was some kind of strange rutabaga.
If you want dessert, you finish that escrow, young man.
As an adolescent, it sounded like something quite different.
Dude, did you see the fight behind the library? Rostorlecki got totally kicked in the escrow.
So I ask Rick what the real definition is, and he goes,
escrow is where they hold the money.
That's no help either, so like any good reporter, I put words in his mouth. You give the money to a third party and they hold on to it until you complete your deal with the seller.
Right, and then all the money goes to the seller and the escrow company takes their cut.
Is that like a percentage of what you pay? Is that what they take? They get a commission?
You know, actually, I don't know how the escrow people calculate what their escrow fees are. I just know everyone has to pay them or there's no deal.
Well, you know who I bet has an expert who could tell us a little bit about escrow?
Who?
Me, back in the studio.
Well, let's talk to you then.
Thanks, Rick. And what do you know? I do have an expert right here in the studio. She's Elizabeth Razzie, author of The Fearless Homebuyer. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi there. How are you?
I am fine. Now, I know escrow has to be a little more complicated than either Rick or I described it. Am I right?
It's frighteningly complicated. The process is different depending on where you are. In California and a couple of other states, it's called escrow. In a lot of the rest of the country, it's just when the contract is pending. But the point is, and it remains the same wherever you are, is this is the period between the time you reach a contract and the time you hand over the keys and the money, and all of the details that are laid out in that contract get taken care of.
Can you talk a little bit about this contract? What contract are you talking about, and when does it get drawn up?
Well, a buyer thinks of it as making an offer, but in fact, what you're doing is you're writing a contract when you make an offer to buy a home.
So basically, when I make a bid, I do more than just say, I offer you $500,000 for this house.
Exactly. You're not just talking about money. You're talking about all of the terms. You're saying that I want to close within 10 weeks. I expect to see the curtains and the drapery rods still there. I expect to see the chandelier in the dining room.
Is this also where I hear about these mythical things called inspections happen?
Yes. You ask for any inspections that you want in that purchase contract. And during that escrow period, or when it's under contract, that's when you get the inspections taken care of. And you have any repairs made that are called for from those inspections. You get your mortgage finally approved. All of those things happen then.
Now, obviously, we are in a buyer's market. So I imagine buyers now have an upper hand when drawing up this contract. But I've heard nightmare stories about what happens in a seller's market, you know, where they only accept your bid if you, like, agree not to rip down the doghouse in the backyard. Are these true?
In the seller's market, there were really a lot of, I think they're abusive practices, you know, saying, oh, I'll only sell you my house if you have no contingencies. Right now, buyers have the upper hand and you can ask for these really common sense protections.
So going back to this period, which here in California we call the escrow period, so I hand my money over to this third party, and if any of these conditions that have been laid out in the contract aren't met, or if the inspections turn up bad stuff, I can pull out of the sale? Is that the idea?
It all depends on how your contract is written, whether you can just pull out. Sometimes it's written so that the seller has an opportunity to fix things and not just let you off the hook.
Can I ask, who exactly is it that is receiving my money? Who is the third party?
Well, in California and other escrow states, the escrow agent holds all the money. What they do is they collect the money from the buyer and they tend to all the details and make sure all those details in the contract get wrapped up. And then once it's all, the conditions are met, they hand the money over to the seller. The same process basically happens in other states, except there's usually less money involved. On the East Coast, for example, you just write an earnest money check to go along with your purchase offer. And that's not the full amount of your down payment. It could be a couple of thousand dollars.
All right. So how long does this period last where all of these inspections are being done and your money is being held?
It's generally a matter of weeks. In a real boom market like there was a couple of years ago, it was tough to get all the inspections and things scheduled in time for a quick closing. these days, sellers certainly want to wrap it up as fast as possible because they don't want any deal to fall apart.
No matter how long it is, though, I'm imagining that this feels like a lifetime, yeah.
It sure does. I mean, nobody likes to have things unresolved, and that's exactly what that period is. The deal can still fall apart, and that's disconcerting to the seller and to the buyer.
Especially to Rick. The first time he tried to buy a house, it fell through during escrow, after inspectors discovered $40,000 in foundation problems. Of course, that's nothing compared to the fear of signing on to a $500,000 mortgage, as you'll witness in our next episode. Till then, in Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
If you're saving for retirement, you know the importance of diversity. Stocks, bonds, mutual funds. Have you considered adding stem cells to your portfolio? Well, one company wants to help you bank your own stem cells while you're still healthy. If you get sick someday, you could make a life-saving withdrawal. From KPBS in San Diego, Andrew Phelps has the story.
When you hear stem cells, you might think of the embryonic kind. Embryonic stem cells hold the power of new life. But a different kind of cell holds a lot of promise without all the controversy. Adult stem cells can become practically anything: skin, fat, muscle, or brain. If something goes wrong in the body, these little cells jump in to repair the damage. For example, leukemia patients use stem cells to regenerate the immune system after chemo.
There's over 200 clinical studies using autologous adult stem cells looking at treatments for heart disease, autoimmune disorders, different issues in diabetes.
This is Dr. Robin Smith. She's excited about how we might use adult stem cells in the future.
We have no idea how far along science is going to take us, but they're looking at macular degeneration, blindness.
Those cures are still years away. Smith is the CEO of NeoStem, a company that lets you put your stem cells in the bank until science is ready for them. All you have to do is give some blood. Meet Dr. Ron Rothenberg of Encinitas, California. He's having his own stem cells collected.
Let's get the pillow adjusted a little bit. And you might be getting that up a little bit.
We're in a cramped room that's normally used for Rothenberg's acupuncture patients. He's hooked up to two IVs, one in each arm. That noisy machine is sifting out all the stem cells from Rothenberg's blood before sending it back into his veins. It's like tediously panning for gold.
You have good veins.
I have fairly good veins.
Right. 3 hours later, the cells are shipped out to NeoStem's warehouse in Los Angeles. The company cryogenically freezes the cells for a setup fee of about $6,000. Rothenberg stem cells will stay pristine at around 300 degrees below zero. NeoStem can store his cells for the rest of his life. That is, as long as he pays for it. Storage fees run about $400 a year.
It's a real health insurance, as opposed to talking about health insurance. It may be a very standard thing in medicine one day.
Rothenberg is 61 years old and still quite healthy. He works in anti-aging/regenerative medicine. He says aging is a disease.
I mean, modern medicine is great, but it's mostly reactive. But, you know, again, what can we do to stay way ahead of the curve? So this is a potential treatment for existing and even unknown future uses.
I don't think it's either monetarily, biologically, or medically warranted.
This is Dr. Floyd Bloom. Bloom is a research scientist in San Diego and a stem cell policy advisor to the White House. He thinks this is all just medical daydreaming.
We have in Southern California had a lot of tissue banks, from sperm banks of Nobel Prize winners to cryogenic protection of people who are dead and think they can be brought back to life. I look at it as a kind of plastic surgery, a kind of quest for immortality, but it's not really science.
Bloom admits adult stem cells could be used to cure diseases like Parkinson's, but that's at least 10 years down the road. He thinks it's a waste of money to start saving cells now. In San Diego, I'm Andrew Phelps for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts say
the Heritage Foundation estimates
like it's going to be the best
they
quarter.
They decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor, Chris Farrell, to help you sort out what's smart, what's stupid, and what's the straight story. And Chris, you know, I and I think a lot of other folks have had a hard time understanding a recent Supreme Court ruling. And the bottom line here is that the justices made it tougher for workers to sue their employers for discrimination in what they're paid.
That's right. And the woman at the heart of the case, she learned that for almost 20 years, she'd been getting paid less than her male colleagues.
But she didn't find that out until quite a bit later. Yet the court says that a worker has to file a complaint within 180 days. So this woman was out of luck. Frankly, 180 days? That's nuts.
It's a bad ruling. And I agree with Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's dissent. She basically said most salaries are kept so secret, it takes a lot longer than 180 days to realize that there's discrimination at work.
Right.
So Susan Reed, she's a fellow at the Alicia Patterson Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
She came up with an ingenious solution in a New York Times op-ed piece. Congress should require businesses to publish all salaries. And here's a straight story. I couldn't agree more.
Whoa. So we would all know what everybody makes?
Here's the idea. So you have a labor market. Markets work on transparency. If all the mandate is that companies post everybody's salary, and then the labor market will work better. And if there is pay discrimination, it will be readily apparent to everybody, and it'll have to be dealt with because pay discrimination is against the law.
For employees, it seems like there are two ways you could go. One, you could be relieved that you know what everybody's making because it can be a source of a lot of anger within a workforce when
exactly.
People find out that, you know, they're not making as much as their colleague did or, you know, what have you. But at the same time, if all those things were published, it seems like there could be a lot of concern about privacy.
You know, there are genuine privacy issues that we all feel very strongly about. And, you know, there's that old adage we sort of sometimes mention, you know, if you want the world to know what your salary is, tell your children. When they're young, I mean, they're just going to go outside and announce it to the world. That's another way around. That's why we don't tell our children what we actually make. So at the same time, this notion of markets working better always intrigues me, transparency. And we talk about transparency with hedge funds, and we talk about transparency in lots of markets. And the labor market is not working as well as it should be in a lot of cases. And this is one way that might make the labor market, once you've made the transition, once you become used to it, because remember, there's lots of things that we didn't used to talk about
mm-hmm.
that you can't shut people up about these days.
Well, and we're happy to tell people what we paid for our homes, but we're not going to tell them what our salary is.
Exactly. And it used to be, if you go back to your parents' generation, my guess is that they didn't tell people
right.
what they paid for their homes.
Right.
I mean, that wasn't considered polite to ask somebody. Today, if you bought a home, the first thing someone says, how much did you pay for
right.
it?
And you're more than willing to give that up.
What kind of mortgage did you take out? What was your down payment? I mean, you sort of reveal all this financial information, and you think, it's my right to know this.
Right.
Because I might be out there bidding. I need to know this. So there would be an enormous transition period. But it is definitely an intriguing idea, and it would allow for the labor market to work better.
All right. The straight story from our man, Chris Farrell. Chris, would you like to tell me what you make?
I'll talk to you later, Tess.
It's Father's Day this weekend, so I'd like to take this moment to send a shout out to my dad, Ted Vigeland, and all the other awesome dads out there. In honor of the occasion, reporter Kevin Palmer sent us this story.
For years, Ron Busby spent every day at the country club. He was picking up golf balls on the driving range for $5 an hour. It was his only income to support two small children after his wife passed away. And he did it without complaining.
I had a dad who worked hard, had two or three jobs. I had a mother who was a teacher, so she believed in getting an education. And in my generation, we believed the key to success was education.
Busby is the son of a janitor. His father ran a tiny business cleaning offices and houses in Oakland, California.
In my community, there weren't very many affluent people. The first affluent person I met was at a track meet, and this guy happened to be a dentist. He was an African-American, and I was like, wow, this is how I want to live. So I decided when I was in ninth grade, I wanted to be a dentist. The year later, I met another guy that was doing very well financially. And I asked him what he did, and he said that he was an insurance agent. So I said, well, great, I want to be an insurance agent. For me, it was always not necessarily the job, but the lifestyle that I was looking to do. And the career helped get the lifestyle.
Now, Busby is president of American Janitorial Services. That's a nationwide company with more than 200 workers. His conservative dark suit might scream corporate America, but he started at the very bottom of the business ladder.
I went to McDonald's to work in their minority franchise program, where I was flipping burgers, counting change, and sweeping and mopping floors.
After his experience at McDonald's, he returned to Oakland to help his dad's fledgling janitorial business. And then he went out on his own and started his own company. He says perseverance is more important than popularity.
Don't get caught up on the guy who's the hero or the guy that's the most visible. If you look on the shows, the MTV Cribs and all these hype shows, and they always show the one guy. And I say, well, let's look at his neighborhood. Who else is there? What are they doing? Let's not get caught up on the basketball or the football player. But there are a lot of folks that, you know, live in his community that are doing successful as well. And let's concentrate on them.
And what he concentrates on now is what his family taught him years ago. The value of hard work. In Phoenix, I'm Kevin Palmer for Marketplace Money.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, falling down the healthcare rabbit hole.
If you run a small business and you get rated just based on yourself or a few other employees, you may be out of luck finding affordable insurance at all.
Marketplace Money is produced by Wendy Sykes with Nancy Fargali, Rico Galliano, James Richter, Stephen Hoffman, Michelle Phillippe, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.